very active member for ARSC for many years, and a very enthusiastic member too, one who many of you knew. Ed passed away a few months ago before the convention plans were finalized. And we thought it appropriate to open the sessions this time with a few words about Ed Mook. And for that purpose, I'd like to introduce Dr. Helmut Kallmann, who's the current chief of the music division of the National Library of Canada.
Good morning, bonjour, and bienvenue. Welcome on behalf of, well, I can only speak of the music division of the National Library. And I hope you will have a very stimulating and successful conference. There is one great disappointment, however. As Tim Brooks has just said, the man who had undertaken to make the local arrangements for this conference is not with us any longer. And I think it's fitting at the beginning of this conference to pay a brief tribute to our dear friend and colleague Ed Mook. As you may know, Ed was the head of the recorded sound collection at the music division. He had really founded the collection in 1967. Ed retired last July and was busily working on three different books. One was a sequel to his Roll Back the Years, the history of Canadian recorded sound from 1930 on. The previous book was up to 1930. Another one was on the Canadian songwriter and song and publisher Gordon V. Thompson. And the third one he was working on was on the famous Anglo-Canadian leather company band of Huntsville, which was conducted by Herbert L. Clark. Unfortunately, Ed fell ill only after 3 months, I think, of retirement, and passed away shortly before Christmas. His contribution to your field of interest was a very remarkable one. He was a lifelong collector and historian who specialized in Canadian recorded sound. He was for over 20 years a radio host, having a program of historical records, Canadian and otherwise, called Roll Back the Years. He used the name of Ed Manning for that program. He had the idea that Canada should have a national collection of recordings of Canadian interest, whether it's Canadian performers, Canadian composers, or perhaps recordings made in Canada by non-Canadians. And as a centennial project in 1967, that dream or plan of his was realized. The collection was deposited at the National Library. And it has been the nucleus of a growing collection aided by the legal deposit requirement, which was introduced in 1969. So that now we have well over 30,000 discs or tapes or cylinders of Canadian interest. Ed was particularly proud of the collection of early Berliner records, mostly made in Montreal. And he was also proud of the fact that he had interviewed Herbert Berliner sometime in the 1940s. And about 2 years ago, I think the Library of Congress issued a list of their Berliner records. And Ed was very proud of the fact that we seem to have more than the Library of Congress. Well, I've just read the Library of Congress has acquired another big Berliner collection, and we haven't really totaled up. I don't know who's ahead now. Among Ed's special accomplishments were also a number of exhibits. One at the National Library called 85 Years of Recorded Sound, that was 5 years ago. One at the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto, which was, I suppose, 100 years, the from 85 to 100 didn't take 15 years in this case, but somehow I guess nobody knows exactly when recording started in Canada. And perhaps his last great accomplishment was to negotiate the sale of the Harold D. Smith collection, which you will see partly if you tour the music division, and partly if you look at the little exhibit downstairs. But maybe Ed's greatest accomplishment, and that you'll remember him best for, was his personal friendships with so many of you people, his willingness to help people and to share his tremendous memory of facts and of individual recordings and so on with all the people who were interested in it. And I know for a fact that Ed enjoyed nothing more than attending the ASK meetings. And I remember how he came back last year full of enthusiasm and willingness to help organizing today's meeting. Well, we all miss him very much, and in his memory we have established an Ed Moog Memorial Fund, which we hope will serve Ed's greatest ambition, that is to continue building the national collection. We are very fortunate in having a successor in Ed's position who gives every evidence of being a worthy successor, and that's Gerald Parker. Now, would you like to rise? And Jerry and Ernie Dick have slaved for the last several months to prepare this meeting. And I think they've put in 16-hour days, 20-hour days, and they have survived. And I think you will enjoy the fruits of their work. So I hope you will enjoy your stay in Ottawa and take in all that you can. Again, wish you a successful conference.
You've just heard an opening segment from the 14th annual meeting of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections. That was Dr. Helmut Kallman with a tribute to the late Ed Moog. And now on the next cut is overflow material from a session by Raymond R. Weil called Mining Their C's and P's.
An RCA Victor to supply custom pressings. Excess pressing facilities elsewhere also created opportunities for the less than ethical operator. In such a situation, many performances appeared with thinly disguised artist credits or issues of recordings that had their origin in Iron Curtain countries were appropriated. For example, Prokofiev's War and Peace appeared on an authorized pressing, but also on two or three smaller American labels. Broadcasts in which organizations such as the Metropolitan Opera held rights appeared with pseudonyms of European artists. Somehow, all of this paled in the light of the audacity of one entrepreneur who supplied reissues of jazz performances under the Jolly Roger label. Here, one could obtain classic jazz performances deriving from such sources as the Columbia Phonograph Company or the Victor Talking Machine Company, pressed on shiny new 10-inch long-playing records by the custom pressing division of RCA Victor. The practice was discontinued, but at the expense of several red faces at Victor Custom. As the industry during the 1960s became more and more concerned with the concept of the super hit, the practices of the early days were refined and modernized. Now there would be no attempt to sell a production under another label. Why do it? Record labels would be copied and a new counterfeit made directly from a regular pressing. The spurious production would then be passed off through regular trade channels. The development of the tape cassette format also proved a boon for the unethical, since it took but a small investment to set up a duplicating operation that could drain off thousands of dollars from the legitimate producer and the recording artist. Business Week on May 15th, you know, so we've got to have some older dates. We know what the problem is today, but this is something from 10 years ago, so we can claim that it now is history. Business Week on May 15, 1971, estimated that there might be as much as a $100 million market in bootleg tapes. Now they're quoting $400 million and up, by the way. These activities, as well as those involving discs, resulted in a concerted effort by the Recording Industry Association of America to end the practices through legislative redress. Would you go on to the next one, Mike? Mike is being very good to me, but he doesn't realize that I forgot to make an extra copy of page 22, and he's left it out in left field. At first, a series of anti-pirating and anti-counterfeiting laws were passed by individual American states. Afterwards, Congress passed the first American legislation granting copyright protection to American recordings, partially resulting from these hearings. The Sound Recording Act was considered an interim measure, since it was intended to include such legislation in the general revision of the Copyright Act. The new Copyright Act took effect on January 1, 1978. Almost immediately, the Federal Bureau of Investigation stepped in and began several wide-ranging investigations. The first national publicity concerning their operations occurred in late 1978, and there has been repeated actions taken as a result of newer disclosures. The mere existence of a law will be ineffectual unless the courts view the crime of copyright infringement as a serious matter. Unless this occurs, there may be a shell of an industry left in which the legitimate entrepreneur is forced to take the risks while others skim the cream. The industry has always suffered from the less than ethical operator and the Twilight Zone businessman, but now, unfortunately, their efforts and actions may be lethal to the sound recording industry. Thank you. And thank you, Mike. We'll notice an interesting little document involving the Brookman counterfeiting that we mentioned just in passing. There were also other operations in Chicago. There was the Western Phonograph Company, there was Aaron Jones, and I am sure that there are other cases. Unfortunately, in doing this research, this is a spin-off, as much research is. It's a spin-off of research that I've been doing on the history of the industry. And unfortunately, I found the only way to do the history of the industry is to reinvent the wheel and to treat it as if no one has done any historical work before. And that way, you are at least unclouded by preconception. In order to do that, it meant that I went to as many of the major federal courts, their old records, and had to, by just plugging, look at their docket entries. And if you ever want some real work, it's to go back to some old court dockets and go through the things and handle that handwriting, which isn't as bad as mine, but even so, handle that handwriting for 10 or 15 years at a time. Because many of these cases, as you notice, were settled by consent decree. And a consent decree is never reported in any of the usual legal reporting services. So you just have to dig through and find what you find. I am still not completely certain, by the way, whether they did sue on these limited use notices. I have not found it. But if they were going for a small fry person in order to prove it, they might have brought the case out in the federal district court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, which I've only found cases at the present time involving resale at less than the list price. Yes, Steve.
You mentioned a couple of 7-inch counterfeits,
right,
which had blank,
right.
Right, instead of Berliner's name and so
right.
forth.
The vocophones, by the way, were made by pantographing, not by blanking out.
I have a bunch of them which have an extra hole drilled in them. Does that identify which they are with
no,
an extra
no,
hole?
No, the extra hole was meant for the original Xenophone machines, which had this extra little pin that, retractable pin that would stick up or down to help put the record on. That way Xenophone wouldn't be infringing on that screw down device that Berliner had on this thing. Later they abandoned doing it. It was meant to just to make a better contact with the thing. That's what he's referring to.
These are drilled all the way through the record as part of the pressing process.
Yeah.
No, this is not a hand drilling. It is pressed into the record as an extra hole.
It's probably meant to also engage with that type of pin.
Now, you said that there were two different groups of those, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah. There was the one type. There are actually three or four going on at the same time. You have the first standard infringement. I have never found one of those records as yet. Presumably, some were made, but I have never found one with a one in front of the number. Got an extensive catalog, but we don't find any of the products. You then have the Vocaphone ones, which are pantographed, and they're quite neat looking. Jim Smart down at LC was nice enough to let me look at some of this stuff and actually do something which is not good for archival material, but he let me do it for research work anyway, which was to put one on a machine and actually listen to it. And the Vocaphone one, you could hear the needle going down, and you could hear the needle going up in the other one when the sound ended. So we could see that that was a pantograph. And the only way you could tell it was to actually listen to it. They also, if you'll notice, when we were down there, that catalog of Berliner records that they issued at that time has several Berliner records with all of the trademark information eradicated. It's obvious what those were for. Any other questions? Okay, all right. Anyone else?
Here?
Yeah.
First of all, I suppose I should identify myself. My name is Dirk Keatboss. I represent the Canadian collection of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And of course, by that remark and introduction, I simply announce that I'm particularly active in current recording.
Right.
I certainly appreciate your very authoritative and exhaustive research in this subject, which is of great interest to me personally also. But the question I wish to ask is simply that the only reference that has been made at this morning's address of yours to the design which was laid out for us both at the beginning and at the end of your talk, with the P in the circle and the C in the circle.
Right.
The reason
for bringing that out was to focus the fact that really there was no, they were not able to establish that P and C until 1970. Sound Recording Act, I think, was 72. They had tried almost all during their existence, but they did not have success in getting their P's and C's.
Well, now, is my understanding correct that
now, the practice in the British Empire was different. Mm-hmm. The British Empire relatively early did establish copyright in recordings, and one of your Canadian firms recognized that very carefully. We collectors who would buy the Ross Court reissues were wondering for many years why some Ross Court records were pressed in the United States and were for sale, and some were pressed in Canada. The reason was quite simple. The ones pressed in Canada were early enough so they were no longer subject to Canadian and Empire copyright. Mm-hmm. The ones pressed in the United States were still under Canadian and Empire copyright, but the United States had no such copyright legislation and they could sell them out of the United States. So they were running their operation from two bases, Toronto and an American shipping point.
Well, I just want to clarify this point. Is my understanding correct that the C in the circle is part of the Geneva Copyright Convention?
Right, right.
And the P in a circle is part of the phonograph recording convention.
To phonographic copyright.
Of which Canada is not a signatory.
Canada is not a signatory.
But
you are under the basic rules of the Empire Copyright Acts, aren't you?
No.
No, but at the same time,
no,
Canada,
because I know in Great Britain the P in a circle is authenticated
right.
and official, but not in Canada.
Right,
Canada,
not in Canada
apparently is not a signatory to the Phonograph Recording Convention. So that is a point
I just wanted to ask you about because
obviously you've done a great deal more research in this sort of thing than I have.
And also, I apologize. Remember, because of just the labor involved with this, I have limited almost all of my research to the United States. I realize the Canadian problems, and certainly there will be a lot of material coming in about Canada in the establishment of Berliner of Canada, Emmanuel Blount, and the others who were involved with it. But because of the nature of the research, the main thrust has had to be one on the United States. And if it seems that I have ignored Canada, it has not been on purpose. It has just been from the sheer.
That's not the point of this, because
I know
actually,
that. I know
it's
that,
a question,
but I still thought I should still bring it out.
Yes. Well, I thank you very much for your very elucidating address here. It's been very nice. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also, thanks again to Mike Beale, our very patient operator.
Cut three on this tape is some overflow conversation following the session LP reissue of Early Recordings, a panel presentation.
An RCA. I don't. He does.
The National Library has put out a few records over the years, mainly paper records and this kind of thing. They're not really anything very ambitious. But we do have some copies of these left, which I could provide to people to a reasonable number upon request. Also, one thing I'd like to mention, too, since Dr. Coleman omitted to mention it, if you wish to make a contribution to the Ed Moog Memorial Fund, I'm the person who's accepting the checks for anyone here that would like to add to it.
I think on behalf of the panel, I would like to thank our hosts and Tim Brooks. And Tim, would you like to tell us where we can eat lunch now? Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Dave, and panel members. Two brief announcements. Banquet is tomorrow evening. A few people have not registered for the banquet or want to be there. I urge you to do that simply because the restaurant insists on an advance count of how many people are going to be there, and we need to know. It's a little hard to squeeze people in at the last minute. Any ARSC member who plans to be at the banquet should register and leave a check at the registration desk, including, I might add, those who are on the program. Hopefully we'll be a rich enough organization someday that we don't have to do that. There may have been some misunderstandings about that. Outside, people who have agreed to come, non-ARSC members who have agreed to speak to us, of course, are guests of ARSC, both for the convention and for the banquet. As for the program begins this afternoon at 1:30, so you have about an hour and 15 minutes for lunch in the area, and Ernie Dick will give you a few indications of where in the area you might be able to find some food.